Good morning. I'm Ivan Rosenberg. I am the co-founder and executive director of the Aerospace Defense Forum. And I'd like you to welcome you to the first webinar of the brand new Ventura County chapter of the A&D Forum. This morning's topic is innovation and out-of-the-box solutions, what A&D companies can learn from the creation of visual effects for Star Trek. I'm being a long Trekkie. I'm particularly looking forward to this morning. So the A&D Forum is an 11-year-old global aerospace defense community of A&D leaders. There's over 2,400 people in the community. We facilitate communication, collaboration, and commerce relative to the business of aerospace and defense. So we don't get into the engineering. There are 9 chapters, used to be 8 until today, that in the absence of a global pandemic, usually meet monthly. In addition, there's monthly newsletter to everybody who's on the mailing list, over 250 recordings of chapter presentations, and tours of A&D sites that the public doesn't normally get access to. Since the pandemic started last March, to continue fulfilling our purpose, we are conducting about 2 to 3 webinars a month, until in-person meetings can be resumed, and we don't know when that's going to happen. Well, hopefully, maybe after September, hopefully most certainly before the new year. More information can be found at the website, aerospacedefenseforum.org. So a little bit of logistics. You want to make sure your camera video is off. Make sure your audio is muted. If you don't, we'll do it for you, because we don't want you ending up on the recording. You might want to put on active speaker view. That's the button in the upper right-hand corner. You can enter questions through the chat box in the lower center of your screen, and you can enter them at any time. We may address them during the webinar, or we may leave them to the end. And you may note as we move forward, Gerardo, who I'd now like to introduce, who's the chapter chair, and I have been invited by Dan to make this a conversation. So as we go through the presentation, Gerardo and I may hop in and make suggestions. So, Gerardo, over to you.
Thank you very much, Ivan, and good morning, everyone. I will be your host. My name is Gerardo Brusi. I'm the new chair of the new Ventura County chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum and managing director of BrainSpark Consulting. It's a great privilege and an honor to welcome all of you to our inaugural event and also to bring you our first ever presenter, Dan Curry. Dan is, I'm so excited to bring him to the show. I mean, he's one of the best known people for his imaginative and trailblazing work in visual effects as a visual effects supervisor, producer, director of the Star Trek Next Generation series and many, many other features. A career of probably 30 plus years of professional journey. Dan also contributed in many other areas of the industry, including martial arts choreography, main title design, matte paintings, conceptual design, and others. Dan is a veteran of over 100 feature films and 40 television productions, including Star Trek, which honored him with 7 Emmy Awards, 90 nominations, Visual Effects Society Awards for Best Broadcast Visual Effects, an Omni Award, and 3 International Monitor Awards. Dan is a leader in developing innovative solutions and bringing them to life. And Dan will talk about his career trajectory, as well as fun and interesting anecdotes along the way. Dan is past governor of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and is a member of the Directors Guild of America, and past board member of the Visual Effects Society, and was honored as a Visual Effects Society Fellow. So the question that we're going to be asking Dan today is around what can aerospace and defense companies learn from the creativity and innovation and out-of-the-box thinking that is required and used in the visual effects and science fiction industries. So it is, without further ado, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Dan Curry. Dan, are you ready?
Here we go. Good morning, everyone. And let me see, I guess, start video. There we go. Thank you. It's so humbling to be in the presence of such august company. One of the things that we do in visual effects is we create stuff that doesn't really have to work. So our innovation comes from behind the scenes and figuring out how to create illusions, but none of our spaceships really have to fly. So it's all about being playful for us. And so I'm going to beam myself from my present location in my bar at home, and I'm going to take myself to the bridge of the Enterprise. So I might as well get started, and here we go. And so this is a slide I made for you guys. I'm trying to move this. So here's a slide I made for your organization.
And you share screen.
Oh, share screen. Okay, let me go back. Excuse my ignorance here. Share screen.
The green button along the bottom.
I'm looking for it. I've lost my cursor here. Wow. I am sorry. I feel so foolish. I can't find, I can't see my cursor. Let me try this again. Here we go. Share screen. My apologies. Here we go again.
Got it.
Okay. So I made this slide for this event. And today we'll be talking about innovation and out-of-the-box solutions and in the creation of visual effects for Star Trek and other productions. I decided to include other shows because they kind of make the point of what I'm talking about. And here I am with Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, a wonderful person and a great visionary. And without Lucille Ball, we would have no Star Trek. Gene and his colleagues pitched after Have Gun Will Travel and Wagon Train went off the air, for which Gene was writing. He considered Star Trek as Wagon Train to the Stars, and he was a great person to hang out with. Had lots of interesting philosophical conversations with Gene. And unusual for most shows, even the visual effects supervisors got their own trading cards, so I suspect I was worth two Rikers. And once in a while, I would sneak myself in. And here's a case where we predated some events. We had little communication devices that evolved into real life as iPhones and smartphones. And this was a plastic prop with a picture glued on it. And the guys in the art department wanted a deranged, evil, dead scientist on a Cardassian communicator. So we would sometimes put little blue screens on there and burn in or composite moving footage, or sometimes we just have a still like this. And so I was Delcon Ellig. And let's see what's going on here. Oh, want to go to the next one? How do I go backwards?
I'm not sure what you're selecting from, so I can't.
I want to go backwards. So how do I go back? I keep going forward. How do I go backwards?
On the slides, hit one of the arrow keys is want to do it. One of them will take you back. One of them will take you forward.
I'm not seeing the arrow keys.
On the lower right of your keyboard.
Oh, there we go. This is a pastiche of visual effects created for a variety of different shows. This is Moonlight, the Vampire Detective. And in this case, none of this is real, except the actors in the car and the terrain, but the helicopter and the missiles are not real. And I had 4 hours to shoot this whole sequence. This is from Chuck, Star Trek Enterprise. An ethereal being takes over a crewman. This is 2.5D using moving backgrounds from still photographs as in a multiplane. And in this composite, the only thing that's real is the sidewalk and the actor. These shows all the different elements involved. Moving Burbank to downtown. Chicago for Washington. And this was the Warner Brothers back lot for Thailand, using 10 people for a big crowd. And that's what's really there. This is Chicago for Washington. From Deep Space Nine. Thank you. And here's a simple space battle, and this shows a hybrid of technologies as CG, computer-generated images, started to come into existence. They didn't look that good. So when we would have big shows with space battles like I'm about to show you, we would use physical models for the foreground ships because they looked better, and we couldn't shoot models for every ship because there was just not enough time. We had about 3.5 weeks to finish an episode of Star Trek visual effects. And so it would take a day to do a simple flyby with a motion control miniature. So it would be physically impossible to do all this. So we took advantage. Lost that space battle. Here's the model. Okay, now. I don't know why this isn't playing. Oh, here we go. So in this space battle, the background ships are, as I said, CG because nobody is really paying close attention to them. And the foreground ships are the physical models. And in this case, we would have plugs in of damage that we could yank out of the model, as in this case, and put burning stuff in there. And that burning stuff is steel wool being lit on fire over black aluminum foil. That's enough of that. This is the opening title sequence of Deep Space Nine. And what I did here was the theme was we're alone out there. And to show distance, I decided to open with a comet that suggests that we're very, very far away from Earth. And my idea for this sequence was to create a ballet around the space station. And when we were planning the title sequence, I would go into the motion control stage, and we didn't have a finished model yet. We just had a plywood mock-up. And I just handheld the camera and wove around the spaceship, revealing a little bit more about it with each shot, and then just redid it with the motion control rig and the hero model, which is 6 feet in diameter, built by the great Tony Meininger. And I decided to keep it as much in the dark as possible to emphasize the idea of mystery. And of course, tribute must be given to the composer, in this case, Dennis McCarthy. Armin Shimerman, who played Quark, the Ferengi bartender, just had a book published, which he wrote in medieval, in Elizabethan English. And here's one I'm most proud of. This is the opening title sequence for Star Trek Voyager. I'm quite proud of it. It's a hybrid of technology, some CG, some physical models. Like that solar ejecta is handfuls of baking soda shot at very high speed, thrown in front of black velvet. This shot almost didn't make it into the sequence, one of the producers thought it was beyond loathing, and I had to do a lot of convincing to keep it in the show. And everybody was busy, so they let me do what I wanted. So I worked with my team and did my dream of space travel where I'd like to go. And worked with the people at Santa Barbara Studios at the Image G motion control stage. And my supervisor working with me, David Stipes, was immensely helpful in shooting the miniatures. And this planet I painted on a cardboard disc. So, visual effects challenges are not dissimilar to those in aerospace and defense. We have to do constant innovation. We must create things that did not exist before, as everybody in your field has to do. We also have tight budgets, the demand of more for less. The bean counters control everything, so they are constantly demanding more and more production value for a lower and lower investment. We also have inflexible deadlines, and each week the audience and the producers have bigger expectations. And every year, technology evolves and changes, and we must keep current with new developments. And one of the challenges we have to do is build a team. And to create all this stuff, there is a diverse range of skill sets. We need people that can build models, do matte paintings, shoot motion control, supervise on set, imagine how a split screen works. So we need to the right person for the right job so everyone can flourish. And one of the things that influenced my thinking about being about team building is Miyamoto Musashi, one of the greatest of samurai of all time. He developed a double sword style, was undefeated in 61 duels. And as he retired, he moved to a cave and wrote the Book of Five Rings, which on the surface seems to be about sword strategy, but it's actually about team building. And he would identify people as a carpenter, for example, and not literally a carpenter, but somebody who could build things and organize ways of approaching battle. And so if you're interested in working with Japan at any time, I strongly recommend reading the Book of Five Rings. It's short but profound. In thinking out of the box, one of the things that we normally had to do is question what is usually not questioned, challenge assumptions, view the nature of materials and how and their behavior in non-traditional ways. For example, I had one episode where we had to have an invisible spacecraft be discovered by the crew on the Enterprise. And in order to do that, I needed to one of the characters decides to lure the invisible ship into an atmosphere where its heat signature would be exposed. So what I did was made two models, one that was photographable and the other one covered with black velvet, and glued slivers of plastic shopping bag on it. And knowing that plastic flaps in the wind, I surrounded that model with a lot of electric fans, and as I shot its move on the motion control rig, kept the shutter open for 3 seconds a frame so that the flapping plastic would blur. And then I shot a burning newspaper in an old barbecue and keyed or printed that through the silhouette of the flapping plastic. And it looked convincingly like burning gases. So thinking about how materials are, but you can use them in other ways depending on their properties. Liquid nitrogen, another one. Also, I, even as a child, learned to view objects independently of their scale and their original purpose. And playing with physical toys as a child is really important. So those with young children, don't let them just play with screens, because they have to have a physical tactile contact with things to really understand them. And we also, I would encourage my team to think like an artist, and I would encourage them, even if they were not particularly talented in that area, to work with traditional media and seeing things as they are, not as they are, but what they could be.
Dan, let me interrupt you a second on that.
Sure.
In A&D, we're serious, right? We're engineers, and we have specific things to build that have to operate right. And it seems to me, like, in having talked to you and what you just said, that play is an important part of what enabled you to do what you did. I mean, you would see things and play with them, even though they were not necessarily relevant to what you were doing in that moment. But later, you would recall, oh, yeah, I remember I was playing with this thing, and this might be applicable to this, which leads me to the conclusion that maybe if I were leading an A&D company, I'd want to make sure there were time for teams to play.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. A lot of times, if we finish our work for the day, but we are on the stage with various materials, we would just play with them and figure out, make discoveries and how we could then apply it again in the future when a new challenge came up that was relevant. So that's absolutely correct, Ivan.
Yeah, I could see a project team, maybe even having a model of what they were building, and at the end of the day, actually having fun playing with the model, which is unheard of in A&D companies, right? We got to be serious all the time.
Well, even when we were designing shots, we would have little toys that we would either make ourselves, or when toys became available, you'd go into a room and there are grown men playing with little toys. Well, I wanted to do this, and we'd kind of sweep it around, and that's a lot of our design process was playing.
I could see a project team meeting room with lots of little toys, airplanes and rockets, just scattered around for people to deal with. And I think that would be a radical revolution in A&D. But I think necessary to think out of the box.
Yeah, and it's also unfettered. It doesn't have to be real. It doesn't have to be have a specific purpose. But that opens the door to discoveries of things that you might not have stumbled upon if you weren't playing with them.
Right. Thank you.
Here's an example of drawing inspiration from seemingly unrelated things. I had a challenge on one episode to create a spherical alien ship, and this is it. Oh, let me go back. There we go. Okay, so here's this alien ship, which was hidden underground and kind of spews forth into the universe. And I wanted something really interesting and unique with an implied technology. And here it is moving off into another part of space and showing all the elements required to create a shot. So to do this, you need the beauty pass. This is a pass to create specularity or shininess. Here's the matte pass, which is required to make a hole in the background to put it in. Here's God rays and more God rays. And even more God rays, so that it could transition into a hole in the time-space continuum. Here's the interior of that sphere. So we had a partial set with green screen, and these are cleaning up the mats to get a fuller, more even green. And then here's the interior of that sphere, which is all CG. And then here's the finished shot. And I got the idea for that thing from, I lived in Asia for a number of years, and I it was very common to see these beautiful spherical Chinese puzzle balls carved out of ivory. No excuse to carve ivory anymore, but they were amazing works of art. And that was my inspiration for the design of that spherical ship, having multiple layers that would just move independent of each other to make it mysterious and alien. Here's a case where we needed an Andosian escape pod to rescue a survivor from a destroyed spaceship. And we had no money left. So what I did is went to the hardware store and saw a sleeve that's used to repair sprinkler systems. And if you look at the back end of the ship, it's made out of coffee stirrers, and there are anchors for aquarium plants, and the handles are throwaway razors. But if you light it right and you have things to catch light and backlight it so that there's not too much information, you guide the audience to imagine they're seeing something they're not. And this is only about an 8-inch model. Here's another example of drawing inspiration from life experiences. I spent some time in the Himalayas did a long trek from Kathmandu to Afghanistan in my protracted misspent youth, and saw a lot of interesting architecture. So the Klingons, I felt, would have a kind of a Himalayan quality as part of their culture. So here's the final painting I did, which is in two layers. The sky is separate. Then there's the mountain with the structures, and then there's the foreground clouds. And it was inspired by Himalayan architecture. Here's a painting I did in Kathmandu in around 1971. And I was waiting for my trekking permit. And this was the view from my 50-cent-a-day lodge. Then, for my friend Sid Dutton, one of the greatest matte painters of all time, I do a little style sketch. This is a pencil sketch of what I thought early Klingon architecture would look like. And then Sid used that as the inspiration for his oil painting of a Klingon outpost. And then we were able to shoot two actors in front of blue screen and put them down there. And here's another sketch of early Klingon architecture. And here's one of a reuse of something that I didn't expect to ever reuse. This is a matte painting I did for Buck Rogers in the 25th century. And we, again, running low on money, and I had saved the painting, which is about 5 feet wide on Masonite, and just painted a Starfleet logo on one of the buildings. And they drilled a lot of small holes in the Masonite and put tiny lights behind it so I could have blinking lights, and put dust clouds moving around as if there were small vehicles on those paths. And here's a case of combining different technologies. There's a painting of the sky in the background, then a background painting of ruins and desert terrain. But the actual building, which is a Iconian ruin, is actually an enhanced swimming pool filter. And there it is. So it's about an 18-inch model combined with a painting and a pile of powdered walnut to have scale sand. Here's another case of drawing inspiration from life experiences. This is a Chinese fighting crescent. And I thought it would be great if it was used like a staff and had a double layer of blades. And it led to the iconic bat left, which became the symbol of Klingon warriors. And I originally made a foam core version to show the producers, showed some of the tricks about it. Then I showed it to the stunt coordinator, who said, I can't possibly work with that. Then I showed him some of the moves he could do with it, and he immediately became an evangelist for this weapon, which is the first new bladed weapon approved by the Korean Martial Arts Society. And here's Worf demonstrating it to his son, Alexander. Then we had an episode where we went back to a more primordial time of Kalis, the quintessential Klingon warrior, and I thought it would be great to make it more Baroque with more curves and flanges with a special disembowelment flange in the center. And there's Kalis with the physical prop. And here's the Nepalese chorus ord. And then Michael Dorn called me up and said, when he signed on to Deep Space Nine, and said, "Daniel, I need a new weapon." And he explained he wanted a weapon bad enough to take on a batleth, but small enough he could hide behind his back. So Michael came over to my house, and we talked about weapons. And I showed him this one, which I brought back from Nepal. And I said, "Well, why don't we use the tip of this?" And so borrowing that from Nepalese weapon design, then Michael and I created the handle. And I wanted something you could use in any direction, backhand, forehand. And that's what how that came to be used. And you could even throw it like a hatchet. And here's Michael, hard to see, using the mechleth against the batleth. And you can see how so Michael was very happy with it. Here's a case that seeing things not as they are, but what they could be. This is a final composite for a train station done for Chuck. And we were going to shoot on Universal's back lot. And I remember taking a still in Strasbourg, France, of a train station with a couple of parked trains. So what I did is I walked around and found the right perspective point, but all I needed was a green screen behind our key actress. This is Yvonne Strahovski, and the actual back lot. And then here's the train station in Strasbourg. So I, on a piece of clear acetate, I traced all the lines of perspective. Then I went over to Universal, flopped it around, and walked around until the lines of perspective on the acetate lined up with the architecture of the set at Universal. And I said, this is where the lens has to be. And then here's the moving footage. And the train doesn't really move. That's just moving a still train along its own line of perspective. So we cut to that three times. And the same thing, the people on the other train were shot on blue screen and put inside the windows. And here's changing Warner's back lot to Eastern Europe. And here's the Warner jungle turned into Africa in the rain. And these are all digital paintings done freehand. And here's that shot we talked about earlier. This is the actual backlot location, and the producers wanted to move us to Budapest. And so I walked over, and they said, "Well, could we put some Budapest buildings in the background?" And I said, "Well, I remembered shooting some shots in Paris of the Seine River." And I said, "Well, that could look like the river in Budapest. And why not turn the sidewalk into a quay?" And so this is how we did that shot. So I used stock lighting. Here's a shot of Budapest with a shot I did of Paris. The set, the fence is just painted by hand. And here are the elements involved. Showing all the pieces that are required to do a few seconds of screen time. And rebuilding it. And this was a case where I did a digital painting way bigger than a high def frame so that I could do a virtual camera move, even though every element is locked down together. And that would give it a little bit of life. And here's the final shot again. And again, the great Yvonne Strahovski. Here's another example from Chuck. We were going to do an episode set in the mountains of Switzerland, and I went over to the location and said, yeah, this, I could make this look like Switzerland. So I did this digital painting, combined with a background a friend shot in New Zealand, because it was winter there, and we rented a cable car from Palm Springs, and the stanchion holding the cable car up is CG, and then the snow on the roof, the icicles, the hoarfrost, and the change in architecture in the foreground is a freehand Photoshop painting, and then I reused that bit of fence that I did for the scene in Budapest. Here's one from a show called Crisis. That's the finish shot. That's a digital painting, and here's what's really there. They shot in Chicago in the winter, but they wanted it to be outside of Washington, D.C. in the spring. So that's a Photoshop painting using elements I photographed in Griffith Park. Here's another case. This is from Chuck. This is the actual location, but we also wanted it to be in the Swiss Alps. And so same thing. I did a larger painting so we could do a pan tilt and push in to see our characters. So here again, here's what's really there. And here's what I envisioned. And thank you, John and Thomas Knoll, for inventing Photoshop and making shots like this relatively easy. And this shows how I wanted the camera move to work. So you can see the frame at the beginning is big, and then it swoops down and pushes in. Here's another case where we needed a group of people getting off a bus in Moscow, but we didn't want to go to Moscow. So I shot a bus under the bridge building at Warner Brothers, so it would be in the shade and look overcast, and then got a CG fence and hand-painted the mound of snow, painted a little snow on the car, relit the top of the bus in Photoshop, and then just added layers and painted snow onto a statue in the background. And so here's a simple way to go from one place to another. Here's another case. This is on Chuck, because they know I speak fluent Thai. They would occasionally set episodes in Thailand so I could write the Thai dialogue and coach the actors. And here's a case where they gave me this many people, but they wanted a crowd surrounding this fighting pit. And so I needed to do it as a lock off, but I wanted a camera move. So I did the same thing, painted a larger digital canvas and then pieced the actors around, and using a photograph I took in Cambodia of ruins. And here's just having the actors, the extras, change their jackets and hats and move around. And because people are paying attention to the camera moving, finding out nobody really notices that it's the same people, just repeated over and over again. And here's the finished shot, adding smoke and birds for a little life and building up the people. So this is an innovative use of lockdown photography, but making it look like it's a moving shot. We did an episode, the finale of Star Trek The Next Generation, where we go to primordial Earth. And the volcanic plumes are more baking soda thrown up in the air with tinted orange and compositing. And the field of lava is actually a table, which I'll show you in a moment. And we just shot Patrick over blue screen and put him in front of that scene. And so here's some of the elements. The sky is liquid nitrogen. Lava plumes are baking soda, liquid nitrogen smoke. And it's an animated slot gag. It's a little trick to reveal one thing through another, kind of like a moiré pattern to create the illusion of moving lava. And the lava fields, which was basically a bottom-lit plexiglass table filled with methacil, which is a clear substance with the viscosity of mucus that McDonald's uses to thicken their milkshakes, and put burnt cork on top of it. And here's a wide shot of primordial Earth. And the only thing real in the shot is the cave immediately surrounding the actors. And the water is from Laguna Beach. The top left is a digital painting, and the foreground is the bottom lit plexiglass. Here's a Laguna Beach plate. And here it is with the liquid nitrogen in the sky. And here's the miniature, which is aluminum foil covered with crumply paste, paint, and powder. And you can see the table. And here we are, Dennis Herter and myself, preparing the liquid nitrogen for the sky. And here's what that camera saw. So this is typical of, here we go. So these are different elements of liquid nitrogen shot at various speeds. And here I got rid of the center of this material and just used the radiating clouds combined with elements like this. In this case, the liquid nitrogen vapor were in a velvet-lined vat, and I just swatted it with a piece of cardboard to make it do this. And another example of repurposing is years later, I used this on a Michael Jackson music video, Black or White, where I had Michael on a treadmill in front of a blue screen, and he would make hand gestures to punch from one reality to another while he's singing and deafening me with the loud pre-recorded music. So each time Michael would make a hand gesture, I would use this as a wiping element to reveal a new reality within the cloud area. And so here's a use on that planet where the Enterprise had to clean off the atmosphere of a polluted planet. And so the liquid nitrogen was on the surface, and then the beams coming out of the Enterprise are laser beams bounced off a crumpled beer can. We won an Emmy for this one. And here's the liquid nitrogen element bounced off a beer can, or the laser element that was scrunched and skewed to become the tractor beam. I also used that same laser element. I spent a day playing, as Ivan was talking about, with a friend's garage who had an industrial laser, and just shot it through crumpled plastic, melted plastic, and saran wrap. And I wound up using that as a non-corporeal entity in another episode of Star Trek. Here's another use of liquid nitrogen. It's the only substance I found that would create miniature forest wildfires, and by tinting it orange and blowing it, running over a giant table covered with black velvet with air jets, and it whipped up the turbidity to create the illusion of fire. Here's a cloud tank that we use to create atmospheric effects, and using milk or paint or heavy cream to create the illusion of clouds. And here's a set of Deep Space Nine, a partial set. And then here's a CG. I did a reference painting, and then my friend Brandon McDougall did a CG version, and we moved the partial set into the background. And then added fire so we could change the light, and then it got more intense, and here it is in moving.
Yeah, I'm really curious. How did you do that fire?
That was real fire shot at different angles.
So we didn't kill any actors?
We almost killed one. One of the stars had to punch one of the actors, and he reached a little further than he did in rehearsal and broke his nose. And he was wearing heavy prosthetic makeup, so when they pulled the makeup off, it was absolutely excruciating for him. Okay, here's a typical scene in the Okay. Here's a finished shot, going pretty fast, showing all the elements required to put a shot like this together. And that planet is made out of dog dew. A macro shot of dog dew. We didn't sculpt it. My assistant was getting out of his car and planted his foot in something that had been Alpo. And I was looking for this texture. And so we just wrapped it and put a little weather system over it. And it became Ficus Canis, used in 7 episodes. Here's all the elements needed to put a shot of the Enterprise together. We needed a minimum of 7 passes of it doing exactly the same thing. Here's my homage to the original War of the Worlds. And I took a 18-inch skeleton and painted it so it was grisly. Here's another shot drifting on an asteroid in the holodeck. I still have that rock.
So, Dan, how many people were involved, or did you need to get together to do one of these shots? And how did you inspire your team to be so creative and imaginative?
Not everybody would work on every shot, but we probably had about 80 people off and on at different parts of it working together.
Wow.
And we had motion control people, camera people, model builders, matte painters, compositors, animators. And my job was to be the inspiration and the designer for everything.
Yeah. One of the things I've been listening to you, and the number of people you talked about, you had to have a really clear idea, and everybody had to have that idea of what the finished product was.
Right, and I would do storyboards so people know. I didn't put any in the presentation, but I would do very detailed storyboards of what I wanted the sequence to look like. I would do conceptual paintings for people to look at so they'd get an idea of it. And I found that the ability to draw was invaluable in communicating. The old adage, a picture is worth 1,000 words, is absolutely true. And this way, the directors, the actors, everybody could see what my intention was. And it just simplified everything. So I would encourage everybody, even if you're not Rembrandt, practice drawing on a daily basis. I still draw every day.
I see an analogy to SpaceX in that, you know, they're doing a lot of stuff, but there's an overall picture of populating Mars, you know, having the human species survive by being multi-planet. And so even though they're doing things on a daily basis, that ultimate picture is what's present for them. Much like when you do, you know, all the different elements that have to come together by different professions have to come together, but you're getting it real clear about what's the end goal here. And I think that's often missing in A&D. We get wrapped up in the today's to-dos, today's technologies.
Well, one of the things for us, too, is story is king. And so I was always very careful to make sure that all visual effect shots served the story. They weren't there for their own sake or our own self-aggrandizement. And so I would want the audience to have experienced the evolution of the story for the 3 seconds that the shot was on, or the 15 seconds, whatever it did, that it was always there to serve the story and push the story along. Here's a case where 7 of 9 went to see the spaceship where she was a child on that had been wrecked on a planet. She's accompanied by our Vulcan Tuvok. And so this is what I envisioned, and that's what's really there. We were just on set, and so we just traced the edge of the rock, and then I just did a painting of the background, and then our CG people did the wrecked ship, which ultimately crumbles and falls off the cliff. And if you see in the background, there's a little target for the actors to look at, so I know that that's where I wanted the wrecked ship to be.
Dan, we're running a call.
Oh, I just saw the time.
Yeah, and there is a Q and A. There's one question that came in that I'll ask you as I.
Do you want to stop the presentation?
Yes, if you would do that, please.
Okay, let me find the.
To stop share should be in the upper red box.
Finding my cursor is the challenge.
Ah, okay. Anyhow, the question is, what's the next coming technique? Where's Industrial Light and Magic as a competitor or collaborator?
Oh, Industrial Light and Magic is the best company in the world. And right now it's headed by John Knoll, a truly brilliant man. And John and his brother Thomas, among other things, invented Photoshop, which literally changed the world for image making. So, ILM worked with us a number of times, and John did the solar sailor for an episode of Deep Space Nine, a solar wind powered spaceship. And John also did the spaceman for me on the revised title sequence for Deep Space Nine.
Fabulous. I wish we had another 2 hours. Thank you, Dan. Gerardo, you want to bring us home?
Yes. So first of all, Dan, thank you very much for this. I think it's been very interesting, very excellent presentation. Thank you very much. Just to let everyone know, the a recording of this webinar is going to be posted on the AMD Forum website under presentations and National Online Forum. This is available to AMD members. And all attendees will receive an email when the recording is available, along with contact information of the attendees who get permission for their name to be given away. Ivan, you want me to talk about the upcoming events, or you want to take this on?
Oh, okay. So there's quite a few webinars coming on June 9th. Wells Fargo is going to talk about M&A trends. And if you're a small to medium-sized company, how to be prepared for what's coming. On June 11th, one of the prime analysts, what's going on in the commercial aviation world, Richard Abulafia. He is a very often writer for Aviation Week, and there isn't any major aviation conference at which he doesn't speak. This will be his second presentation to us on what's likely to happen in the commercial world. And then on July 15th, another editor from Aviation Week, Jens Flota, is going to talk about the future of the widebody. A lot of controversy on, is the widebody dead, or is it going to see a renewed life? And he'll talk about that. And then on September 23rd, Larry O'Toole, who's spoken many, many times at the AAD Forum, how do you do a business health assessment for your company? What we've seen is many companies don't know what their enterprise value is, how they're doing, what their weak spots are, what their strong spots are. And Larry will take you through how to do that. We invite you to become a member of the A&D Forum. That gives you free attendance at all the A&D events, and maybe equally or more important, access to the over 250 recordings that are available to members only. And they go back 11 years, and there's some classics in there. So thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Gerardo, for your first webinar. You'll be handling it all from now on.
thank you.
If you've got suggestions for topics or speakers, let us know about them. We hope you have a great day, and we'll see you at a future A&D Forum event.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.